Welcome everybody, this is Dolphish 365 Developer Patterns and Practices webcast. Once again, we'll have some interesting things to talk about, and this time we have actually three persons in the call. My name is Vesa Juvonen, I'm a Senior Program Manager in Office 365 Engineering, and today we're going to talk about actually really kind of an interesting topic around the remote provisioning versus the feature framework. So why are we actually, especially in PnP and in general in MSDN, already starting to say that you should stop using the feature framework? So what is actually behind of that statement, and what is the justification, and what is the replacement for the feature framework in a SharePoint Online or in a SharePoint on-premises? I do have two PnP core team members with me in the call. So there's Bert and Irvin. Do quick intros for either you guys. Bert, we'll start.
Yes, Vesa. So I'm Bert Jensen. I'm a service engineer in the SharePoint and OneDrive service engineering group. Erwin?
I'm Erwin van Hune. I'm a product owner at Rancor, and I work with transformation tooling there.
And Bert, I just noticed that I know that you as a senior service engineer. I'm not sure what's your actual title right now, but it really doesn't matter.
You're looking into the future.
Okay, cool. Maybe I'm already predicting something. Doesn't matter.
Maybe.
Sooner or later. Anyway, let's move on. Concentrate. So let's actually, the whole topic is around the feature framework and the feature framework usage. So what's actually wrong with using the feature framework model within the SharePoint Online or actually in the on-premises as well? And the answer is that there's a big challenge when you start using the feature framework. Well, first of all, the feature framework, yes, that was introduced back in 2006, and part of the SharePoint 2007, and it's now 2016. It's 10 years. We have much better models to take advantage right now. The old model within the feature framework, it has a challenge where we create a strong dependency on provision assets and some of the configurations in the feature framework and the content. And what I would mean with that one is that, as an example, in a farm solution perspective, you will create a dependency on feature XML files within a file system. Or in a sandbox solution perspective, you will also create a dependency on that sandbox solution to exist and being activated in that particular site collection. And that really is the main challenge around the feature framework.
So, Vesa, you're talking about sandbox solutions. So this actually does mean that feature framework is supported and works for SharePoint Online.
Absolutely. It is still so completely supported. We're not going to actually just cut away the sandbox solution from SharePoint Online. And it's been supported there since the early dawn of SharePoint Online. The declarative sandbox solution supported, the code behind sandbox solutions not no longer supported in SharePoint Online. I think that's the right now, the current status in the early 2016. But the key point,
It is an important notice that sandbox solutions which have code are deprecated and will disappear, because you will see in the upcoming slides that you will have to use some code to, when you switch framework, you're kind of obliged to use code as well to do the actual enterprise scenarios. And since code in sandbox solution is not allowed, it makes it kind of hard to use them in SharePoint Online.
Absolutely, and especially in certain scenarios related to an upgrade. And we'll kind of talk about those in a second. Let's actually have a good example. So this is really a classic example around content types and site columns related on that dependency. This is actually taken from the PnP training materials from the module 10, if I remember correctly, something which we created way back at some point. This is not recommended approach, but this is the typical approach where people are actually creating feature framework features. They deploy their content types using XML. They have a content type definitions in feature XML files, and then you activate that feature in an existing site collection. This is relatively typical scenario, and I know that Irvin has been doing that when he was a consultant in his previous employee. Bert was doing that when Bert was a consultant. I was promoting this in my consulting years as well.
The reality is,
sorry?
Many times.
Many times, yes, exactly. Exactly. And this was the case to do, because in before, I think, certain timeframes, we didn't actually even have a proper APIs to do this even in server-side. Now, the challenge of doing this is that you will have a dependency on that feature XML file to exist in the farm. You can forcefully retract that farm solution from the farm, and what will happen is that the content types and content which was created in the content database, which had a dependency on the content type, those will still exist in the content database. So they're not actually broken. The content will be still accessible, but the content type which is in the content definition, which is now in the content database, which no longer exists in a file system, will say that I was actually created using a feature XML file. And what that will mean is that at some point, if you, for example, want to update or maintain the sites or delete the content type from the site collection, you can't. SharePoint is going to say to you, if you're trying to delete the site, the content type from a site collection, SharePoint is going to actually throw you an exception and saying, well, you cannot delete this content type because this content type was originally created using the feature framework elements, even though the file does not exist in the file system. And that's really a kind of a classic example. What is the challenge around the content type manipulation with the feature framework? And in some sense, the same issue actually is well, the same issue in some sense is in a sandbox solution. The scope is slightly different because sandbox solutions we activate in a site collection level. But then if you retract the sandbox solution or deactivate the site collection feature, retract the sandbox solution away from the site collection, yes, again, the content type will still remain because there was content for the content type. You would actually, all of the content types which did not have content would be automatically deleted. And then what if you need to redeploy the content type with any of the updates? SharePoint feature framework does not support updates. If you would like to, let's say, add a new field to the existing content type to make it visible within the existing lists or existing items, well, the feature framework does not support that. The feature framework does not support updating of the existing instances and existing items, which is a really, really important thing to realize.
I actually just think of another scenario where this dependency between the file system and the content database is an issue, and it is migration scenarios where you want to migrate the content from one server to the other farm. True. You will have to make sure that the file system of the target farm is up to date with all the features. And I've seen scenarios where people say, yeah, because we exported all the WSP packages through some scripting and installed them on the other farm. And it turned out that some features were actually manually installed on that farm. So they are part of the WSP package. So we'll have to find them and then copy them over and manually register them in a farm, which is quite a hassle, to be honest.
Like a big mess.
It is a very big mess, yeah.
And we have people that have tried to upgrade features, thought that you can simply change feature XML and deploy it again, and that will work. And then you get an even bigger mess.
Anyway. Another thing I would to bring up is that on the previous slide you mentioned that the features don't really support upgrading, and I'm sure there's people out there who say, but hey, there is an upgrade functionality in features. And yeah, there is. But then, first of all, they're not really the easiest to understand how that works with the versioning numbering. And second of all, if you look into what you can do with a feature upgrade, is either run custom code, yep, like an event receiver, or you can add a field to a content type.
And that's it.
And that's it.
And the custom code and sandbox solution is deprecated, so exactly, which doesn't exactly give you a final solution.
No. And the custom code in a sandbox solution is anyway highly limited from an API perspective, so you can't do really as much as with the server-side APIs, or even with the CSAM API. Actually, with CSAM, you can nowadays do more than with the sandbox solution server-side API.
No.
So what would be then the right thing to do? And this really applies then for SharePoint Online and also for SharePoint on-premises. And this is kind of a generic slide on trying to explain the model. So what we want to do is actually provision the content types as an example, or whatever it is, list instances with the specific fields or columns, using actual code, using then the CSAM or RESTful APIs, or upload the items and assets to the right location. Uploading a file to a SharePoint list is actually two lines of code. or if you're using any of the remote provisioning frameworks, which we will explain slightly later, it's just a matter of defining a one-liner or, well, in XML, or executing one line of code, which is really, really understandable. But now, the key point of this one is that you're actually creating the content type precisely in the content database, in the site collections, and the content type itself does not have any dependencies of any of the external assets or XMLs, and you don't have to have a sandbox solution activated in the site collection either, which will then remove the possible case scenario where the site collection administrator accidentally goes and deactivates the sandbox solution, because we've seen those happen as well.
Absolutely.
In on-premises, coming back on the, let's say, the backup and restore scenario, so the scenarios where you want to move that content database from one farm to another, this is actually brilliant because you don't have any dependencies on any WSP packages, which would have to be deployed in a farm either. You have just the content database and move it across and you'll be fine.
Professor, this is a code-based approach, but people also use the content type hub. Does it use the same technology on the root?
Well, that's actually a brilliant point, Bert. The content type hub actually is doing exactly the same thing. It is creating those content types into target site collections using code. Now, the question is, then you would have to get those original content types in a content type hub. You would either, well, create them using manually or using the remote provisioning, not using with feature framework. But then when you publish a content type from a content type hub, the SharePoint will just create that same content type to every single site collection what you have within the same service application's scope.
Yes, so those content types will live in a content database just like they were created via code, and actually were in a good state at that point.
Exactly. So that's absolutely a valid case. Well, the content type hub would cause some additional questions and challenges, which we will not talk about within this webcast, but that's a different discussion. Let's not even go there. Otherwise, this webcast is going to take like 3 hours. The good example of a one more time and a slightly different perspective, and there's a lot of examples why the feature framework has challenges. The modules, whenever we are deploying assets to the file, classically within a farm solution scenarios, we've been deploying master pages and page layouts and CSS files and JavaScript files using the module element in a feature framework. What will happen is that you actually have which is a good thing. You have a one version of truth in the 15 Hive or 16 Hive, depending on what SharePoint version you're running, or 14 Hive as well. Now, and that will give you the nice benefit of actually having a one version of a master page, just pointing to, as an example, pointing to a file within the server. So you'll just deploy a new version of the WSP packages, and voila, all of the instances of master page has been updated, unless they've gone unghosted. And that's really the one of the challenges when you do farm solutions. Unless you really block the permissions of the end users, you do not know which of these assets are in a ghosted status or in an unghosted status, unless you will again write code and analyze that using the values within the database. So how could we fix this is quite simply. Deploy those assets to the right locations within a site collection, and again, you will have just the content in a content database. You're not using feature framework. You're just uploading the master page or BNP file or a JavaScript file to the right location within a site collection, and voila, you'll be good to go.
And to add to that, I see on the slides, CSS files, PNG, JS. Some of these assets, you can also put them like externally in a content delivery network on a one central location. So you don't even have to put those in each and every site collection, which kind of simplifies the story as well.
Exactly, sure. And then you don't have the ghosting, unghosting issue, because you can guarantee that way that they are effectively ghosted.
And there would be a one version of truth still, because it's the CDN which is actually hosting those static assets. And even in the case of master page, if you would be doing a custom master page, so that's absolutely debatable, especially in SharePoint Online or in Office 365. Not going to actually concentrate on that topic in this webcast. But if you would be using a custom master page, you would have to get that in every single site collection within a SharePoint Online. Now, if you would use a classic model, you would create a feature framework or a design package. We're going to talk about that one slightly later. You would activate that in every single site collection to get the master bytes available in there, which is extremely difficult actually to automate. And then you would have the challenge of having a dependency on the content to that sandbox solution. Creating a PowerShell or a small piece of code which is uploading the master base to a right location without any dependencies on feature framework elements or anything like that is like six lines of code. So that will actually, and then you'll just loop into the site collections and get the master base deployed. Hopefully that made sense. I'm just rambling on a random topic.
Just to confirm. just to confirm, because for years and years, and that includes me, I've been saying, and many people around me, like, unghosted files are bad. Ghosting is the way to go. We need to have a file on the file system, and that is the single point of truth. And if there is a unghosted version in a site, make sure that that version is not unghosted, ghost that version again. And now we're actually saying the opposite.
Correct. And when you think of it, the reason why we're saying the opposite is really much the fact that we want to align the on-premises deployment model to the SharePoint Online deployment model so that it's not an exception. And also due to the fact that if you would do the ghosting, so the file would be in a 15 hive or 14 or 16 hive, you would have that dependency in your content database to make sure that that farm solution has been deployed. If you have a disaster recovery story or whatever, you have much more difficult way of handling these files. You're absolutely correct, Irvin. When I was delivering MCM, the master certification trainings, I was always saying that you need to make sure that the files are actually properly ghosted, they're all in 15 hive. But then the situations do change. That original statement is from 2007. And at the time, yes, it even had a performance impact in exactly. SharePoint's performance. Now we're living in 2016. The performance impact on the fact that it's the file in a file system or is it in a database, it's no longer meaningful. The comparison between, if you lose two milliseconds or 20 milliseconds, that's peanuts compared usually to the custom JavaScript files and HTML files which people will be using. Yeah. Cool. Moving on topics. So what we wanted to do is pretty much then talk about random statements, what people are then could actually be quoting or asking after based on the fact that we're saying do not use feature framework. Really, when you think of it, especially in the case of sandbox solutions and farm solutions, yes, the feature framework and the Visual Studio tooling and WSP packages are brilliant. We've been using them for 10 years and they just magically work nowadays when the tooling is fine and tooling is polished. Using DDF files and makeup access was painful back in 2007, but luckily we evolved on a higher leap. Anyway, you would be using those the WSP packages. How would you update those sites? How would you go and modify, for example, a customer comes with a requirement and saying we need to enable additional languages to be supported in this site, or we need to switch the regional setting, we need to update a new site column to every single instance within the site. Well, you would actually have to write some code. You would actually have to do feature receiver based code or a console application and run server side API or CSAM based API in a SharePoint Online to make that happen. So isn't that kind of awkward when you think of it? You're using XML only for initial deployment, and then you have that dependency on the XML to still exist in the file system. You can't get that one away, but you can't no longer update the feature XML because updating is not supported in feature for XML. Well, except for the scenarios what Urban mentioned.
Yeah, that's indeed strange. That actually raises the question, like, why shouldn't we just simply use code from the beginning?
Exactly.
And I do know environments and solutions where actually the features do not contain a single declarative artifact. They only contain feature receivers. That is actually very, I've seen that quite a lot actually in solutions where all the features were just basically simple shells, empty features with an event receiver behind it, where all the provisioning took place in code.
Yeah, which is not a bad thing for on-premises. Actually, that's almost like a semi-okay approach and for on-premises, because then you would not have a dependency on those files within a file system, unless you would use something like list definition or a site definition, which is giving chills, but that's another discussion.
But still, upgrading those features would mean that you actually redeploy the WSP package, and then you go to the site, you either do through code, activate, deactivate your feature, or you route the feature upgrade.
Correct.
It's an additional step you have to take there.
Yeah. So you would still run into this challenge that you would have to pretty much run the code anyway, run some code to upgrade the capabilities, which you have deployed in a V1.0. So in the longer run, the big picture, the reality is that every single deployment we need to version, we need to maintain. Then the question is, what are the costs of maintaining that SharePoint deployment? Because it might get really complicated in some of the scenarios with the feature framework. Now, one of the things what we really wanted to mention are the sandbox solutions really a challenge with SharePoint Online as well? And the answer is yes. Just making sure that we cover that. We mentioned this already when we chatted in previous slides. There are challenges in a sandbox solution, even though you would be using the declarative deployment option. And you run into this exactly the same challenge. Yes, I'm now deploying a new version of master pages and page layouts and deploying some content types and site columns to my site collections. First of all, how do I update hundreds of or thousands of site collections? Well, I would have to scan them through and write some code or PowerShell which will manipulate those sites one by one. And again, you have to fall back on the code. And then you would deploy those assets on the sites. And then there's always the challenge that in quite many cases in the enterprise customers, the actual site collection owners are site collection administrators, and they can accidentally go and mess up the feature XML, feature deactivation activations, or the sandbox solution activation and deactivation. And this, again, really the updating scenario. Yeah, Bert.
Right. And another potential problem is that, especially when you start creating large sandbox solutions, is that you get issues at activation time. So activation times out or doesn't complete, kind of gets stuck halfway. We've seen those issues in larger environments.
Yep.
So it doesn't seem like a very good solution, especially in the enterprise context.
Okay. Comparing to the fact that if you're running code, you don't have that timeout challenge. You can actually do a deployment of individual files one by one in a patching solution or in a PowerShell or either way you want to do that. And we're going to show some stuff slightly later on the webcast as well. Moving on things, there are a lot of statements what we wanted to go through and clarify some error around this feature framework usage. One of the questions which we quite often get around this topic is that I'm building SharePoint hosted add-ins and I need to provision elements like the list instances. What should I do? You're saying that the feature framework is not the option. Well, this is now the exception, which is, well, confirming the rule or what's the right saying. The SharePoint hosted add-ins is fully an exception on this recommendation. The SharePoint hosted add-ins are only deploying assets inside of the adding web or app web, whatever you want to call that. And the features are always scoped in the web level. So all of the things are in this add-in web or app web perspective. And it's a great way of getting some of the list instances available. Because if you're creating a SharePoint hosted add-in, you cannot run code. There's no way of doing that. Because the app installed event would only work, that's app installed event only works with a provider hosted add-ins. So SharePoint hosted add-ins, absolutely supported, absolutely still a valid approach. Hopefully, again, that made some sense, guys.
Yeah. Well, you can question why you would still use SharePoint hosted add-ins, but I think that's not a topic for
this. Yeah, let's not actually even start that discussion. That's a different discussion. The SharePoint hosted add-ins, yes. I personally, just a quick, that is a side discussion. But for me, SharePoint hosted add-ins are like sandbox solutions. Highly limited, yes, they work in certain subset of scenarios. When you really want to do stuff, you don't want to do SharePoint hosted add-ins. But that, again, different topic. Cool. Now, one of the statements which we're quite often hearing then as a follow-up on this, all of this discussion is Visual Studio still promotes the feature framework-based model. Why does it do that? Why was releasing these Visual Studio versions which are promoting that? well, are we actually promoting that? We're not. If because the reality is that we need to still, even though we are releasing new version of Visual Studio and new version of SharePoint, we as a Microsoft always have promised to do backward compatibility on the SharePoint. And that's really the reason why the feature framework elements and even site definition wizard exists, which is kind of a funny thing as well, exists in a Visual Studio as a template. It does not, however, mean that we're promoting that. So it's not really the promoted and recommended way to do that. The official recommendation from Office 365 Engineering and Product Group is really to start gradually moving into remote APIs and a remote way of deploying the assets. And yes, maybe at some point Visual Studio will have tooling on this one. Maybe not, who knows? Or maybe it's a community-created tooling, which will use, for example, some of the feature remote provisioning frameworks. We'll see what will actually happen. And actually, Irvin, you had a good point around the is this actually...
Yeah. If you reason that Visual Studio promotes the feature framework, you can also say that, hey, Visual Studio also promotes SharePoint 2010 solutions, because that's also in that list.
True. That is a fair point. Absolutely. Cool. Just to clear up additional stuff, we know that some people are using design managers and design packages, not that many, but we know that some people are using this for publishing sites because they only work within the publishing sites. And just to be clear, design packages are actually also sandbox solutions. These have the same timeout challenge, what Bert actually mentioned. So if it's a large design package deploying a lot of stuff, it might time out. It is actually sandbox solution, and it's always activated in site collection level. So the managing of the updates with this is also a challenge. You can maybe in certain scenarios, if you are familiar with using the design manager, you might use that to create some assets, create the master base, create the dependencies between the files. But we would recommend still to use the remote provisioning as the tool to deploy those assets to the SharePoint itself. Making sense?
Totally.
Cool. And final kind of a statement before we do a quick look on the feature framework, the remote provisioning frameworks out there. When you think about this one from an end user perspective, so what is actually the difference between the feature using the feature framework or using the remote provisioning engine? And the reality is that from an end user perspective, there really is no difference. This is a technical discussion. This is really about how does the IT or a developer get their stuff deployed to the site collections. This is not an end-user-driven discussion because the end-users do not see these capabilities or this anyway within their UI, usually. Except Irvin, once again, has
exactly. Yeah, you say usually because there are environments and they're actually more and more common where site collection administrators are regarded end users, and people developers roll out functionality that site collection admins can activate or deactivate at will by going to the features of the site and activate a feature, and they get this additional web part maybe or an additional list or whatever that feature deploys.
Yes.
So. Those scenarios, it would be effective. Of course, there are answers there, but using the add-in model, you could create a page where you have a button where people click on that does the same thing behind the scenes using CSUM. So you could provide similar experiences, but they can be affected in a way.
True. The site collection administrators, yes, they can be in certain scenarios impacted by the change. To be fair, at least from my personal perspective, after spending 8 years in a consulting, helping the customers to do SharePoint, I would never, ever, ever, ever teach my site collection administrators to use feature framework UIs to activate and deactivate stuff, because that will end up in a massive mess, because at some point somebody's going to start testing, what if I activate all of this? And then it's like, okay, that's not what you should be doing. But anyway, again, it slightly depends. There are different kind of scenarios, different kind of customers, different kind of use cases for all of this.
Yeah.
Cool. This is more a reference slide. And to be fair, it's kind of a reference slide around the open source remote provisioning frameworks which are out there. So there's the BNP, Patterns and Practices Site Provisioning Engine, and then there's this SP Meta 2, which is a great tool as well. The PMP stuff is what we do, me, Bert, Irvin, and a few other stuff, day-to-day basis. So this is, we don't want to compare these two different frameworks. The SP Meta 2 absolutely has a lot of value as well, and a great framework. It, by the way, also supports the fact that you're able to use the same code-based provisioning just using the server-side API. So the model is the same, the code-based provisioning of assets. The code-based provisioning of assets is also in the PMP side. But both are comparable. It's not up to us to make a recommendation based on this. It would be an unfair discussion.
But the key message is that both help you stop using the feature framework.
Correct, yes.
And be future-proof, and that's the key thing to remember here.
Yes, both of these are using the remote provisioning model. Both of these are future-proof. They are actually looking into using the right APIs to get the stuff in. And you can, use that, both of these, in on-premises or in the SharePoint Online. And please check more details on either of the engines on the links in the video descriptions as well. Now, we know that there's a lot of people who still have strong feelings about the feature framework and don't quite understand what the remote provisioning might mean. So let's have a typical example. Let's actually provision some assets to multiple site collections with remote provisioning and apply some updates to them. The question would be, how would I do this in a sandbox solution? How would you actually, provision some assets or lists and site columns to multiple site collections, and how would you maintain those updates in the future stages? Irving is going to do the demo. I think, Irving, you're using PowerShell for this one. But it's not just it's a PowerShell, the PMP PowerShell engine, which you're using for that one. But that's just a tool to really automate the scripting. Right, Irving? Irving, you're muted.
Well, I will say yes for Irving.
Yes. Thank you for taking that seat. Cool. So let's actually have a look on the demo, and we'll be back on the slides just to summarize the deck.
Okay, so in this demo, what I will show you is that I will first provision a list. And what you're looking at right now in Visual Studio is the XML representation of a provisioning template. Just to emphasize, you don't have to use XML with the provisioning engine. You can use a fully code-based approach, but for demo reasons, actually, I think the XML approach is actually quite nice. And it also allows you to very easily move templates around from developer to developer instead of moving code around. So what you're looking at right now is a list instance called projects. And I set a couple of properties. It's a custom list. I add a couple of content types, a couple of views and fields. It doesn't matter that much what's in those specific elements underneath there. I'm going to show you what it will look like if I provision this and what the end result is of this template. So I move to PowerShell, which is my preferred environment, and I connect to my little script for that.
That's your preferred development environment.
It's my preferred debugging environment, I would say.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. PowerShell was just a big scam of ensuring that IT pros can learn how to write code.
It is actually. Good point. So I connected for the developers among you. I'm basically creating a client context object here. So I'm applying a provisioning template to that site. Now, what I did actually, I wrote a little script. So I could do this manually, site by site by site. But I wrote a little script, and that is create lists. And what this script will do, it will connect to two site collections on my farm and provision the template you're looking at in Visual Studio to those sites. And that site, I have one of those sites open here in my browser. You see there's in the quick loans, there's no custom lists here. So I go back to PowerShell and run this script. So it will connect to the site and apply the template. And there you see, it will, in this case, apply the list instance. And when it's done with this site, it will go to the next site, being the demo 2 site, and apply the next list instance to it, the template to that next site. There we go. So in the meantime, I can already go to this site. If I reload this thing, you will see here, there's the projects list provisioned to that site. And the script could continue side by side by side by side if I want to behind the scenes. If I click on new item, you see the new form of that list. And you will see there's my title and a project type with the taxonomy field. Now, at a later moment in time, I decided that, hey, I need an additional column, an additional site column in this list for every site that I have that uses this list. So if I go back to Visual Studio and go to the another template, so this is the actual, the same template with an addition. So what I did here is I added a site field. And it's a very simple choice field with an internal name called office location and has three choices, Stockholm, Helsinki, Brussels, which actually happened to map to the home bases of the people in this webcast.
What a coincidence. What a coincidence. What a
isn't it? Yeah. So then we have the list. This is the same list that was already in the other template, but I added this little field reference here. So effectively what I'm doing is like, hey, list, add the specific site column that I created up here, add that to the list. And that's only changed to this template.
Erwin, on that one, you don't actually specify anywhere an add operation. So what
no,
will happen?
No,
I'm just
no.
making sure that we're actually covering it.
Indeed. I'm just modifying the list instance that I had in my template by just adding that additional column to it. Yeah, I'm not saying like, take this list instance and add that. No. I'm just creating the whole list instance. This has a benefit that if I run, create a new site collection in the future, and I want to provision this list to that new site collection in its current state, I do not use the old template and then apply the second template. No, I just use the second template. I basically could have modified the template in place and then provisioned that template again to the site. So if I say here, update lists, what it will do is effectively connect to the same site and apply the second template. And when it's done on this first site.
Yeah, it's going to recognize the existing site, the existing list, comparing that to the current definitions in XML.
Exactly, and updates it in place. Yeah. So it updated the first site now. So if I reload this, there we go. There's my additional field.
And now I think the key question, what we mentioned already in the presentation, is how would you do this in a sandbox solutions? Well, you actually can't. It's impossible.
No.
The feature framework doesn't support this kind of capabilities. And this particular approach is a brilliant example of the fact that this would work in the SharePoint Online and in on-premises exactly the same way.
Correct.
There's really no difference on that one. It really is a great example. And then the key point to also understand, if there would be hundreds of thousands of site collections, well, it's just a matter of looping through. Give me a loop, run through the site collections. Yes, it's absolutely true that, well, at some point, just some of the site collections might have been updated and some of the site collections could be still in the process of getting updated. But it doesn't actually cause any downtime either. You're just manipulating the site collection by site collection and introducing those additional elements, what the remote provisioning framework is bringing in,
yep.
Which is a good thing to consider as well.
Great.
Cool. Anything else we want to actually mention here? Probably? No. I don't know.
No.
No. But thank you. So just to summarize on the demo as well. So the demo is using the BMP remote provisioning engine. The SP Meta 2, which we mentioned on the slide, can do pretty much same capabilities as well. The key point is that we are manipulating the live sites. So essentially what we did was that what end user could have done manually as well. But thinking of that among, let's say, hundreds of thousands of sites, going one by one to site collection, creating that site column, adding that to site column to all of these list instances one by one within the site collection level, would be extremely time-consuming term. Using the remote provisioning engines, we can automate all of this stuff extremely easily with few lines of PowerShell or few lines of code. So a really, really great example why the remote provisioning is much more efficient and future-friendlier than the sandbox solution or even the farm solutions. Let's move back on the presentation. Thanks, Erwin. And excellent, Erwin. Great demo. And really, like mentioned, it's all about how would you do the same topic if you would have thousands of site collections and you would be using sandbox solutions, or even farm solutions could be problematic. Or, well, in the case of farm solution, you would have to fall back on the code as well. But that really sums up our webcasts, and we wanted to really touch base those common questions around why is Microsoft starting to say that don't use feature framework? What's wrong with that? So we wanted to touch those common statements. If there's any, let's say, things which you disagree or some topics which we didn't cover, feel free to ping us in the Yammer. So if you go AKAMS Office Dev BMP Yammer, please use that Yammer group for the questions. We're more than interested to have this discussion openly and transparently, because we want to make sure that the community is using the right tool for right purpose, which will minimize the future maintenance costs related on updates and maintenance, whatever happens within the product or in the service side. So hopefully the webcast was useful. And thank you, Irvin and Bert, for participating me on the recording.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you.